Parshat Masseh is the end of Sefer Bamidbar, and the last chapter in the chapter divisions, which is, really is its own separate parasha, is these 13 psukim that describe the aftermath of the Bnot Slavchad interaction. And it's a very understandable circumstance, except that when we look at the end of it, something odd occurs. So let's take a look at through these psukim. The background, of course, is that we know that Bnot Slavchad have been given Yerusha, and Bnot Slavchad therefore are going to inherit land in the Menashe territory, the land that belonged, that was going to be going to Tzlovchad or Tzlovchad's holding. All right, so what happens? Vayikrivu Rashi Avot Mishpacha Bnei Gilad Ben Machir Ben Hashel, Mishpachot Bnei Yosef, Yadabu Lifnei Moshe, Lifnei Asim, Rashi Avot Bnei Yisrael. All right, so the leaders of the Gilad family come. Vayimru Et Adonai Tziva Adonai Latet Et Haaretz Benachala Begorali Bnei Yisrael, Vadonai Tzuva Vadonai Latet Et Nachlat Tzlovchad Achinu Livnotav. And so this is probably a good spot for us to look back and see that original interaction with the Bnot Slavchad circumstance, because I'm going to ask a couple questions that I want you to keep filed away as we read this. Question one is, what is Bnot Slavchad's motivation in coming forward? What is it they want? Now, before going further, what is it that we think? Because, by the way, Bnot Slavchad is a parasha that we read either last week or 2 weeks ago, depending where we are. So what is Bnot Slavchad's motivation in coming forward to Moshe?
Inheritance.
Inheritance. For what purpose?
Because they're orphans now.
Their father is dead, and therefore what are they concerned will happen?
That the uncles are not going to take care of them, or that they're going to lose their piece of land when he gives it out, when it's given out in Israel.
Very good. And then when they get married, what will happen? Yeah. Okay, good. So let's take a look at it, because that's so simple. All right. Here is the story of Bnot Slavchad. I want to back it up to find the first mention of Bnot Slavchad, which is just prior to their story, which is in the census. Now, the census has a couple of oddities that I want to look at. In the census, when introducing Shevet Menashe, which interestingly enough is presented as Bnei Yosef is Menashe, and then Ephraim's thrown in also. Bnei Yosef Mishpachotam Menashe, Ephraim Bnei Menashe, Machir Mishpachah Machirim, Machir Alon Gilad, Gilad Mishpachah HaGiladi, and who are Bnei Gilad. And it sounds like Menashe's got one line, which is Machir. Machir has one line, which is Gilad. And Gilad is the one who has all of the families that make up Shevet Menashe, maybe. Eilu Bnei Gilad, and we got all of the names. And if you look at the end of Pasuk Lamed Bet, there's Chefer. Utzlovchad ben Chefer lo hayu lo banim ki im banot. And by the way, this shows up every time that Tzlovchad's mentioned or Bnot Slavchad are mentioned. It doesn't say Utzlovchad hayu banot. It always says Utzlovchad ben Chefer lo hayu lo banim ki im banot. Right? We got to see why that phrasing is there. V'shem Bnot Slavchad machla v'noach chogla milka v'tirtza. There's their names. Why do we need to know their names? Why are we concerned? Et cetera. So that's thrown into the census. Now, the simplest read of this is it's foreshadowing, because immediately after the census, we're going to hear about Chalukat Ha'aretz, and Bnot Slavchad are going to come forward and say, oh yeah, I remember them from the census. Okay, could be. But there's some other oddities in the census that we'll see in a couple minutes that might put it into a different light. Now let's look at the story itself. Vatikravna Bnot Slavchad ben Chefer ben Gal ben Machir ben Menashe, Mishpachot Menashe ben Yosef, by the way, which is the same kind of lineup that we saw, we'll see in Perek Lamed Vav. Ve'elu Shmo Bnotav Machla Noach Chogam V'Chogam Lo Kav V'Tirtza. Batamodna Lifnei Moshe V'Lifnei Elazar Kohen V'Nei Asim B'Chol Hayda. So this is a public approach, just like, what other public approaches do we have when people come to Moshe in front of everybody?
Pesach Sheni.
What? Pesach Sheni. We have it also with certain rebellions. All right, and it's also going to happen with Bnei Yosef at the end of Bamidbar. Meaning, they're trying to make this a public stand. This isn't privately asking a Shiloh. This is a public stand. Petach o'moy limor. Avinu meit Bamidbar. Okay, so father's dead. V'hu lo haya betoch ha'eda hanu'adim al Adonai ba'dar Korach. And for some reason, they find it necessary to point out that that Slavchad was not part of the people who died in the rebellion led by Korach, Datan, Aviram, whatever, however we read that as one or two rebellions. He wasn't part of that. Why do they have to mention that? So that's actually fairly straightforward, because there's good reason to think that the people, and the Gemara says this, is that the people who participated in the rebellions did not get a right to land. And so therefore, Tzlofchad is not somebody who's deprived of land. He should have land, right? And then it's a kibachet omet. And then there's all sorts of interesting midrashim on what that means. Simple pshat in kibachet omet just means he died a regular guy. Everybody has sins. We all die because of chet. The Gemara famously says that there are only four people in history who died without chet, right? Yishaya, Vidavin, and Binyamin, etc. But he died in not part of that. Uvanim lo hayulo. And he had no sons. Now, he's our father, so do the math. We are sisters, and we have no brothers. Lamayi garashem avinu mitoch mishpachto ki'in lo ben. Why do they keep saying that? And by the way, again, whenever time Tzlofchad is introduced, lo hayu lo banim ki'im banot. And why do they have to say, banim lo hayu lo, lamayi garashem avinu ki'in lo ben? Why should his name be diminished just because he has no son? We want to have some of our own property. Now, what's the simple read of this? Exactly what you said, Jason. They want inheritance. And what's their motivation for inheritance? They want to have Tzlofchad's name on land. They don't want Tzlofchad's name to disappear. And now there will be five little parcels of land that have the name Tzlofchad on them, Machlabat Tzlofchad, Choglabat Tzlofchad, etc. Very nice. Problem is, it doesn't actually work. We'll see why not. Crave Moshe Mishpatam Lifnei Adonai, and what is Hashem's answer? Kain Benot Tzlofchad Dovrot Natom Tetem Lahem Achuzat Nachala B'toch Achei Avihem. They should get property. Vavartan Nachlat Avihem Lahem, and they get that property that should have gone to their father. Very good. Now, we follow that up at the end of Bamidbar. This is where we started. We're at some later point. Meaning this is not that same stand. And I'm not doing that based on Mukdam Mukhar Batorah, the fact that Maaseh is after Pinchas. But simply the read of this text makes it clear that Moshe has already issued the ruling that Benot Tzlofchad are going to get land. And now as we get closer to that being a realization, maybe closer by a day or two, but we get closer to that realization, it seems that it's actually closer by a lot longer than that. Chavit Midyan being in the middle, etc., that there is a problem that their tribesmen bring up. All right, and we already saw Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Bet as the lead-in. Now, Pasuk Gimel. Here's our concern, Moshe. They're going to marry somebody among Bnei Israel. You got to remember, Bnei Israel are not the way we think of it, which is as one single nation. We're not in Chumash. On the other hand, we are not 12 totally separate and independent nations, autonomous nations, that have formed a convenient alliance in order to go to war. We're something in the middle. We are 12 nations of one nation. Amim har yikrav, right? In the beginning of Vezot HaBracha, there seems to be a mention of nations coming together that are what make up Am Yisrael. All right, we understand that. But we're certainly not autonomous. We all are under one nomos, under the law of Hashem. And we have one Mishkan, and we have one leader that brought us out of Mitzrayim. We have a unity there. However, we are separate tribes, and that becomes the issue here. So Benot Tzlofchad will marry somebody from, Chogla will marry somebody from Zvulun, and Milka will marry somebody from Dan, right? And we Tirzah will certainly marry somebody from Yehuda, okay? And then what's going to happen? V'nigra'a nachlatan minachalat avoteinu. Now what's going to happen? Their own section will now be removed from Menashe's territory, or Chefer's territory, if you want to get closer. V'nosafo nachalat amateh shetiyan alam. So what's the problem? So Chogla marries somebody from Zvulun, and then Chogla and Zvulun have kids, and they have sons and daughters, and the sons inherit the territory. And what shevet do those sons belong to? Zvulun. So in the middle of Menashe territory, there's going to be something marked off that says Zvulun. And then, oh, by the way, we, Shevet Menashe, are going to have diminished property as a result of it. When we go on the Chaltenu Yigareh, V'yai Yovel in Israel, and this is not just a temporary problem, that when Yovel comes, this is one of the famous three V'im's, that's not Reshut. This will then become permanently enshrined as Zvulun territory. And it will eternally be removed from Menashe's boundaries. All right? That's our problem. Now, here you would expect, based on what's happened in Bamidbar, with Pesach Sheni, with the Mikoshesh, with Benot Slavchad, you would expect Moshe to turn around and say, okay, Hashem, what's the answer to this problem? Instead, something curious happens. Right? Sam Moshe b'nei Yisrael, p'i Adonai le'mor, kein matei b'nei Yosef dovrim. Now, what does that mean, al-p'i Hashem? Does that mean that Moshe stands there and Hashem is speaking to him and telling him what to do? Seems not. I can't swear it, but seems not. Watch how it plays out. It says, and by the way, kein matei b'nei Yosef dovrim is exactly kein b'not slavchad dovrot. Just substitute the names in there and change it from masculine, feminine to masculine to get the same phrase. Cain, Matei, B'nei, Yosef, Dovrim. They are speaking correctly. As we would say in Yeshiva, they're saying good. Shaper Kamer. Zeh ha-davar she-tziva Adonai livnot slavchad le-mor. Which zeh ha-davar makes it sound like this is what was part of the original command. But I didn't mention it yet. And you got to wonder, well, why didn't you mention it when you told B'not Slavchad the beginning land? What was the rider on that gift? Latov b'neihem tiyana l'nashim, they can marry whoever they want. Ach mishpachat matei aviyem tiyana l'nashim, but they have to marry within the Shevet. Is that so awful? It's not like saying you got to marry a guy in on a tevka. We're talking about tens of thousands of available men they can marry. Right? And now, what's the purpose of that? We agree Hashem agrees with what you're claiming, or that was part of the original command, that the Nachala should not switch from one tribe to another. We want everyone to stay on their ancestral property. And therefore, what will happen? Chogla will marry somebody from Menashe, anybody from Menashe, big field. Tirtza, etc. They'll all marry from Menashe, and therefore their sons will be from Menashe, and then this will be Menashe territory. All right, and that will solve the problem. And then this expands out. It isn't just for Benot Slavchad. Any girl who inherits territory has to marry somebody from her own tribe. And parenthetically, the Gemara Darshan's Zehadavar as saying that this only applied in this generation and only during this period. And famously, at the end of Masechet of Tanit and also in Sugya Mabatra, it maintains this is one of the six proposals of what Tu B'Av was about. What Tu B'Av was, a couple years after the conquest and division of the land, was when this prohibition was lifted and girls, even girls who inherited territory, could marry in any tribe. But what happened to the territory? That becomes an interesting issue. And in the meantime, it stays with, she has to marry within the tribe. So everybody should inherit their own ancestral property. And you get the sense that this is a critical thing. The Torah keeps repeating it. Now, what happens? And this is where it gets problematic. That's why I made it big. Just what Hashem commanded Moshe, that's what B'not Slavchad did. Notice the order switches. Is this the order they got married in? Is this age order, wisdom order? We don't know. B'not Slavchad, who'd they marry? It doesn't say Livnei Menashe. What does it say? It says Livnei Dodehen. Okay, so what's a Dod? What does the word dod mean?
It's not an uncle.
It is. But it's not just an uncle.
Right.
Does your mom have any brothers?
No.
Okay. Does your father have any sisters?
Nope.
Okay. So let's see the difference, right? Dovi and Zevi, do you guys, your mom has any brothers? Okay. That's not a dod. Does your father have any sisters? They're husbands. They're not your dod. Who's the only person who's a dod? Your father's brother. Right? Father's brother is a dod within the context of Parshat Bahar and expanding out and his role as a goel. And it's definitely related to dod. Beloved one is the one who takes care of the family. So who did they marry? Bnei dodehen, which means they married other grandsons of Hefer. They married their first cousins. Okay, now, this is where things get strange. What was their big concern back here at the beginning of the story when they approached Moshe? They said, who's going to get the land? Our father's brothers. That's not fair. We should get the land. I said, you're right, you get the land. And now what happens? They end up marrying those same men who they were concerned were going to get the land. They marry their sons, which means what happens to the territory? The territory now goes exactly where they didn't want it to go. What was accomplished then with the whole B'not Slavchad legislation? Kind of strange. I'm going to add one more piece to it that I keep alluding to, which is about the census. And then two more oddities here, and then try to put it all together. You take a look at the census, and this isn't the whole census. Census is very long, but there's a certain things I wanted to highlight, and I made them a little bit bigger. We hear about several anomalies in the census, meaning unlike the census in Bamidbar, which is very straightforward, here, in four cases, we hear something extra. One of the cases is the shame about Asher Sarach. Right? That's not that significant for us. The first one is Reuven. The second one is Yehuda. And the third one is Menashe. There's an expansion in their census. Look at the expansion in Reuven. It's all about Datan and Aviram and how they died and the earth swallowed them. Finished. But Uvnei Korach lo metu. Interesting little addendum to that addendum. And then we go Shimon and God and Shimon and God and then Yehuda. And how does Yehuda start? Bnei Yehuda Shelava Feretz Vazerach. That's how it should start. Instead, Bnei Yehuda Erv Yonan Bayamot Erv Yonan Feretz Kanan. Who cares? That's a long time ago. Why is it important for me to know that Aaron Onan died? Insignificant. And then when I get to Menashe, I suddenly hear about Benot Slavchad. Why are these three families singled out for expansion in the census? Everybody else is, these are the names of the families, this is how many people they are total. Move on. Why? So I show you another oddity that takes place. It takes place in Sefer Yehoshua. Benot Slavchad don't disappear after Sefer Bamidbar. They show up in Sefer Yehoshua. Sefer Yehoshua, as you know, is roughly divided into, we'll call it four sections. All right, there's the first, we'll call it five prakim, which is sort of introduction, entering the land, etc. And then there's the kibush that starts with kibush Yericho and goes from Perek Vav roughly to Perek Yud Bet. Perek Yud Gimel through Perek Chaf is the division of the land. So Perek Yud Gimel is the division of the East Bank, and Perek Yud Dalet is a prep piece about Nachlat Yehuda, which is the biggest, which is Perek Tet Vav, which is huge, and gives all the boundaries of Yehuda and all the towns in Yehuda. It's very big. Perek Tet Zion is a very short piece about Ephraim. Perek Yod Zion, a bit bigger, about Menashe. And then Perek Yod Chet is sort of the introduction to the rest of the Shvatim and Nachlat Binyamin. And Perek Yod Tet is detailed of Shimon and Yisachar and Zvulun and Asher and Naphtali and Dan. And then Yehoshua, where Yehoshua gets land. And then Perek Chaf, the shortest Perek in Yehoshua, Paradigm Psukim, is the command of the Arei Miklat and which cities is set aside on the West Bank for Arei Miklat. Perek Hafal, a very detailed Perek, which is the Arei HaLevim and which tribes gave which cities to which families of the Levim. Perek Hafbet to the end is the end of Sefer Yehoshua, the Brit and sending the two and a half tribes home and then the Brit. And then the passing of Yeshua, etc. All right. In the passage about Shevet Shev Menashe, we have the following. Litzofchad ben Chefer ben Bin Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe, lo ayu lo banim ki im banot. Nochamo, we have the same introduction. Ve'ele shmot benotav, as if we didn't know, machla v'no'av chogla milkav etirtzah. And again, the order is a little bit switched. Vatikravna, lifnei Elazar ha-Kohen, lifnei Yehoshua bin Nun. Who approaches the leaders? The girls do. And then it describes actually the Chablei Menashe, and they get territory. Who's coming forward to Yehoshua and Elazar here? Benot Tzlofchad. Who should be coming forward?
Their husbands.
Their husbands should be going forward. Where do you ever find in Tanakh where a married woman, except when playing a game, such as the Isha Tkoit, when she's married, and Abigail, who under obviously very bizarre circumstances, comes forward to the leadership alone? Or even at all? It's always a man. So what are Benot Tzlofchad coming forward for? Their husbands, who, by the way, are also, because they have a stake in it, it's their territory they want to get. Why aren't they coming forward? So one last thing, and then we'll put it all together. There's a sugya in Yesh Nochlim, the eighth parak of Babatro, which is all about Nachalot, has a whole sugya about Benot Tzlofchad, and about Tzlofchad, famously, the Mishnah says, Benot Tzlofchad Nachalu, Shloshah Halakim, they got three different kind of vehicles or conduits for inheritance. All right, and in that sugya, we have the following agada. Tani Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, afilu ktana shebehen lo nisei pchuta mi-arba'im shana. Says the youngest of them married at 40, meaning it sounds like they got married and the youngest bride of them was 40 and the other ones were older. Okay, which is odd for a bunch of reasons. But like, why would he say that? And where's that coming from? Aini, how could that be? And watch the attack. The attack is not, supposed to get married earlier. Why? The attack is coming from a different direction. The Amar of Chista, Nisei Pchutami Bat Esrim Yoledet Ad Shishim. Interesting reproductive math. That if a girl gets married before she's 20, she can have kids till she's 60. Bat esrim yoledet ad arba'im. If she gets married at 20, she can have kids till she's 40. Bat arba'im, if she gets married at 40, shuv eina yoledet. I'm not going to even try to figure out what's behind that. But they're taking this as physiological reality. But a girl can't start having kids, if she starts her reproductive life at 40, it's not going to work. So, why is this a challenge? The fact is that they were righteous girls, and because they were righteous, they had a miracle. Each of them had miracles happen to them, and the miracles were like Yocheved giving birth according to the Midrash at 130. They gave birth at an advanced age, even though they got married late. Okay. How does Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov know that they were so old? Where's that coming from? And why pin that on them? And how does he know they had kids? Now, parenthetically, not long, I don't know how long ago, but sometime in the last 50 years, they found some pottery in the area of Menashe, I'm assuming it was Adam Zartal found it, that actually had the name Chogla on it, which seems to indicate that the Chogla family and maybe other of the families which kept the matriarchal names, did succeed in having progeny, etc. But how does he know they had kids? So let's roll it back, because by the way, if they don't have kids, then it's not a question. And if they get very young, it's not a question. So let's roll it back. What is it Benot Tzlofchad really wanted? What was their concern? They state their concern is we don't want our father's name to be erased. Okay, we've been together long enough that you know, how does a person maintain his name through history? Through what two vehicles in Tanakh? In Tanakh times, what are the two vehicles for posterity?
Land.
Land and children. And that's why Geula applies to both of them. We go back to the Dod. What happens when a man dies? He was married and he dies without children. The brother has to step in to redeem his name. His name should not disappear. And what happens when a person is forced due to penury to sell his ancestral land? His Dod has to step in and redeem it. And remember, what was Boaz's big statement? I am buying the land and I am marrying Ruth Lahakim Shem Hamet al Nachlato to keep the name of the dead man, Elimelech, alive on his property through having kids with Ruth on that property. That's the whole thing combined. Okay. So Benot Slavchad come forward and say, we don't want our father's name to disappear. We all think that means we want there to be land that's called Slavchad's land. And therefore, if we had brothers, that would be fine. We don't have brothers. And if it goes to Slavchad's brothers' sons or Slavchad's brothers, our father's brothers, then it won't be called his. It'll be called theirs. We want his name to be on land. What little JNF sign? Property of Slavchad. Donated by the Slavchad community of Reb. We think that. But then we run into the big problem, which is, but since they're going to marry, and in the end, they marry within Menashe, and who do they choose to marry? They choose to marry specifically those same people that they were trying to keep the land away from. They seem to have defeated themselves. So I'd like to suggest a different take. And it takes for us to remove ourselves from the 21st century and go back to, we'll call it the 12th or 13th century BCE. But you don't have to go back that far. Just go to the ancient world anytime, the classical world, even the medieval world. Why did people get married? People did get married because they went to camp together, they went to high school together, they met in Bnei Akiva. They didn't. Why did people get married?
I mean, they get married to either to have kids or, and also security. I mean, for
them. Yeah, but why marry that girl?
The clans.
It was all about financial security, about tribal alliances, about military alliances, economic alliances, whatever it was, creating building alliances. What made a guy desirable such that a father of a girl would want him to take his daughter? Well, if he was wealthy, if he was important, if he could provide well, that's fine. What would make a girl desirable? Some of the same, and that was enunciated by a huge dowry. Now, these girls are orphans. Avinu Meit Bamidbar. They are very clearly single when they approach Moshe Rabbeinu. That's without a doubt. And they have no one to speak for them. What is their real concern? Their concern isn't we're not going to get land that, and therefore that our father's name won't be listed on a map of Israel. What are we really concerned about? We're not going to be able to get married. Who's going to marry us? We don't bring anything to the table. So what does Hashem say? Kein benot slavchad dovrot. And what happens as a result? Benot Slavchad get land. Now that they have land, or now that there's a promise of land, it's not marked off yet. That's going to happen in Yoshua. Now that there's a promise of land, they're suddenly attractive marriage partners. Okay. And now what can happen for them? They can get married and have kids. And now what will not be erased? Slavchad's name, because Slavchad will have grandchildren. That's what they're trying to preserve. Slavchad's progeny. Okay. So now Bnei Yosef come along, and they're concerned about the land component. And Moshe says, you're right, that was part of the original command. Why did I not mention it then? For a very simple reason. Where were we when the original Benot Slavchad interaction happened? We were in Arvot Moav, getting ready to go to war against Midian, and then getting ready to enter the land. It was going to be a time of war, not a time for weddings. Right now, Benot Slavchad have a promise of land. We don't have to be concerned about who they're going to marry. We'll deal with that later. After we enter the land, after we fight, then they'll marry. Bnei Yosef come ahead and they say, well, listen, Moshe, but we have to put some guarantees in place that we won't lose the land. Says, okay, you're right. That was part of the original command. Very good. So now what happens is they enter the land and they fight. And who comes forward after all the fighting is done? And after the land has been divided, and we can identify not only where Menashe's territory is, but where the subset that belongs to Hefer, Grandpa Hefer. You know where that is? Who comes forward? Benot Slavchad. Still unmarried. After all these years, they come forward. And Yoshua gives them the land. Now that they have real land, what happens? Their family members who have inherited right there marry them. In other words, Slavchad's nephews, who are in the same right in the same district, marry them. Makes a lot of sense. It's Dina de Bar Mitzvah almost. The right of first refusal of the neighboring property. And now, before going further, you can understand why in the census, there was a singling out of Datan and Aviram, as opposed to Bnei Korach, Aaron Onan, and Benot Slavchad. They were, what do the three have in common? These are families where sons were not there. And in some famous way, there's no sons. Either Aaron Onan died way, way back. Datan and Aviram died just now. Bnei Korach are not dead. They're still around. And Slavchad died without sons. It's all about progeny. And so what happens is, after the girls come forward and get their land, then they're married. That was when Yaakov comes along and says, okay, that means they were at least 40. Because how old were they when they approached Moshe? We have to assume they were at least teenagers. They had to be able to speak publicly in front of Moshe. They weren't 6 years old. And then you have to add to that another few months till they cross and 14 more years of fighting and dividing the land. So by that time, they're getting close to 40. So he says, okay, the youngest one was 40 when they got married. They probably all got married at one time. How do I know they have kids? He says, mitoch shetzid kaniyote. Their entire motivation was to keep their father's name alive. And that indeed happened because they were able to have progeny. That's where this midrash comes from. So we can't sign off yet because you're going to hit me over the head with Pasuk Yod Aleph here. And you should hit me over the head. Because I'm claiming that Benot Slavchad at Moshe's funeral were all alone, not married. I'm claiming that when they crossed the Yarden, they crossed as five single girls. And they spent the whole time of the war and the division of the land still single and only afterwards got married. And yet here in part in Sefer Bamidbar, at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, the third to last pasuk, it says they got married. But it shouldn't surprise us. We find several other examples of this. This is something the Ramban talks about earlier in Bamidbar in Parshat Chukat, where there are events that the main story of that event is in the Torah, but its conclusion is later on in history. And the Torah will tell that story. Let me show you two quick examples right here before we go. One example is, one example is right here in Sefer Shmot. In Perek Tet Zayin of Sefer Shmot, which is the story of the Man. All right, when did the Man happen? The whole story of the Man happened between Egypt and Sinai, right? Right, a month after leaving Egypt, We come to Midbar Sin. We're hungry, complain. The next morning there's man, Shabbat, all of that. Now, watch what happens at the very end of this story. Vayomer Moshe, zeh ha'davar shetzivah Adonai, melo ha'omer memenu lishmor al dorotechem. Take some man and put it into a container. L'man yirut alechem ashachalti etchem b'midbar otzi etchem me'eretz Yitzrayim. Right. So, good. Put together a little memorial souvenir of the man. So people should know. Very good. And Moshe tells Aaron, put it in front of Hashem. What does in front of Hashem mean? So, I don't know, you don't know, we don't know. We have no idea what that means. But we'll find out in a second. So just like Hashem told Moshe, what did Aaron do? He put it in front of the Edut. What's the Edut? The Edut is the Aaron. That includes the Luchot Ha'edut. Testimony to Ma'amad Har Sinai. By the way, this is still before we got to Har Sinai. Okay, so that's pretty easy. And the way to explain this puzzle, everybody who takes a look at this says, listen, Moshe Rabbeinu completed the Sefer Torah before he died. So he filled in the rest of the story. Because subsequent to having this piece of man, which they got every day, so they didn't need to save one, so that they put it together when there was an Aron, and they put it in front of the Aron. Very nice. This is the problem. All right, again, Moshe Rabbeinu can write that, no problem, because he's completing it at the end of Arba'im Shana. Ad bo'am el eretz noshavet. When did they eat it? Until they came to the settled land. At tamanachu ad bo'am el eretz Kanan. They ate it until they were on the edge of the eretz Kanan. Which edge? So if you look at Sefer Yoshua, it means the inside edge, meaning they ate them on until they were already in Kanan. When was that written? It's a little problem. We have what may be a more obvious example, more glaring example, if you will, in Parshat Chukat. Here at the end, after Aaron dies, the first thing that happens, famously, is there's a war. All right. And Bnei Yisrael make a neder, im naton titen tamazeh biyadi v'achramti et arehem. If you let me win this war, I will make their cities chera, meaning dedicated to God, who won't live in it, etc., like Yericho becomes. So God listens, and they're able to beat them. And what do they call the place? Chorma. And then we have this curious passage in Sefer Shoftim, in Perek Aleph. Vayelach Yehuda et Shimon achi vayakur takhani yoshev tzfat, not the tzfat we know, vayachrimu ota vayikrat shem ha'ir chorma. So it sounds like what's happened is a story that took place in Yoshua's time gets written into the Torah. Now, does that mean Moshe's writing it b'nevuah, or does that mean at a later time, as some of the Rishonim suggest, Yoshua or somebody else is writing it b'nevuah and adding it into the Torah? Like the psukim, et cetera. I'm not going to be bothered by that. But when we look back at our source, we could easily say that when the pasuk toward the end of Bamidbar says that Benot Tzofchad married their cousins, that wasn't necessarily something that happened back then in Bamidbar. Matter of fact, it would make very little sense that it happened then, because then who approached Yoshua? It should have been their husbands. Marrying their cousins did not defeat their purpose, because their purpose was not to have independent land. Their purpose was to be able to get married and have kids. And to marry within the very close-knit family was actually perfect for them. The land was the concern of the rest of the tribe, and that was solved with this legislation. It wasn't needed, because that wasn't their concern. But the grant of the land happened in the Midbar. The actual occupation of that land happened in Yoshua's time, after which they got married, and we were able to bring this story to a successful conclusion. So hopefully this gives us a new sense of what happens here with Bnot Tzofchad. And by the way, it's a really perfect kind of ending with Sefer Bamidbar, which is all about inclusion and all about the perpetuity of Kahal Yisrael.